and he needed a search warrant to enter. Sam snapped the suit's photo and stalked off. He railed on about conspiracy theories. Rumor at the precinct had it he'd lost his edge and was coming unhinged. But screw them. Less and less often he got home before his wife and son were asleep. If Jenny woke, the inevitable argument ended with her in tears, and he slammed out of the house and drove to a bar to get shit-faced while obsessing over his notes and files. After one such night, he woke in a hotel with no idea how he got there. It was as if a fissure had opened in his mind, a boundless chasm with no end. On one side, he stormed out of his house and tore into the night. On the other, he woke in a room that reeked of drugs and sex. He stared over that great divide with no idea how he crossed it. He peered out from beneath his eyelids, smacked his lips, and yawned. And his eyes flew open as he sat up in bewilderment. What the hell? What the hell? His head felt like someone had batted it around in a lively game of tetherball. He clenched his teeth and breathed. A heavy knock rattled the door. Police! Anyone in there? A scattering of empty beer bottles lulled on the floor. A bottle of vodka lay on its side on the dresser and had leaked its contents onto the faded brown carpet. In the ashtray on the nightstand lay the remains of a half dozen joints. Next to it, a hand mirror dusted with a white powder reflected the glare of the morning through the thin curtain that hung from the window like his burial shroud. The door's electronic lock beeped as it disengaged. The handle turned. Sam threw the covers back, meaning to leap out of bed and race to the door. Instead, he stared at himself, dumbstruck. He was buck naked. This wasn't happening. His clothes were gone. The door swung open, and two uniformed officers peered into the room, framed by the fire of dawn. Anyone in here? Sam wrapped a sheet around his waist and stumbled out of bed. He raised a hand in front of his eyes to shield them from the glare. Officers, I'm... His legs tangled, and he fell forward and sprawled on the floor. They found 5 grams of cocaine in a glass vial, 3 ounces of marijuana in a Ziploc bag, and a handful of MDMA pills, ecstasy, in a plastic packet. They found his car in the parking lot of a strip club called Runway 69, 15 miles from the hotel. 3 days later, after his balls began to swell and ache and it felt like he was pissing shards of glass, they found he had the clap. But they never did find his clothes. He told Lieutenant Thompson he'd been set up. They drugged him, took him to the motel, and in the morning they made an anonymous call to the cops. They, Thompson said, and stared at him across the expanse of his desk with a look of pity that made Sam want to slug him. Sam rolled his eyes. Is there an echo in here? Yes, they. You said you don't remember what happened. They drugged me. Of course I don't remember. But do you seriously think I spend my time in seedy motels getting wasted and banging strippers? Come on, you know me, Bill. I'm not sure I do anymore. You've been at this thing too long. It's eating you up, man. I'm telling you, I'm onto something with Roman Biogenics. That's why they did this, to discredit me. Well, they did a hell of a job, Thompson said. Sam crossed his arms. You think I'm making this up? Thompson shook his head. Doesn't matter what I think. You're done, Sam. What? I need your badge and sidearm. The hell are you talking about? Come on, don't make this any harder than it has to be. Sam snorted. You've got to be kidding me. Fine, fuck this, and fuck you, Bill. He pulled out his badge and slung it across the desk as if skipping a rock across a pond. It spun along, and Thompson tried to trap it beneath his palm, but missed. It flew off the far side and landed on the floor with a dull, anticlimactic thump. Thompson stared at it, his shoulders slumped. Sam slammed his holstered pistol on the desk and left without another word. 3 decades of service as one of NYC's finest, and that's how his illustrious career ended. Thompson's pitying gaze was nothing compared to the hurt and betrayal reflected in his wife's eyes. She said she believed him, but even if she did, facts were facts. See Exhibit A, gonorrhea. It takes two to tango, baby. He whiled away his retirement, slumped in front of a holoscreen or on a bar stool somewhere, and tried not to think. When he began to wonder whether Sean Jaffe had been nothing but another crazy asshole with a gun, he took a drink. When he began to wonder if he got blitzed and cheated on his wife with a stripper who'd taken his clothes and given him the clap, he took a drink. When he began to wonder if he was losing his goddamn mind, he took another drink. After Jason left for college, Sam moved into the spare bedroom. He and his wife were like strangers, but when Jenny suggested they see a counselor, Sam suggested he see another drink. She'd have stayed with him regardless, as stalwart as Captain Smith going down with the Titanic. But as he took on water and began his inexorable descent into the abyss, he refused to let her sink with him. Instead, he left her, shivering and alone in a vast ocean, yet alive and whole. When Sean Jaffe showed up at his door, Sam's first instinct told him the man was either a body double or a symptom of his madness. When he made up his mind that Jaffe was the real deal, it was a matter of faith, not in Jaffe, but in himself, and that everything he'd done and everything he'd lost had been for something. It was like a douse of ice water that shocked him out of his regret and despair. He felt like a man resurrected. Here were his retribution and the answers to so many questions. They crowded into the elevator, and Chad Dodd thumbed the button for the ground floor.
"Gary Reed was one of the scientists assigned to Project Phoenix," he said. "Ran the show with Bernd Haefler, the guy you met earlier at the lab."
Emma Tyler nodded.
"Reed started going on about how we were playing God. It's like, no shit, Sherlock. That's exactly what we're doing. Our species is fucked and we're fixing it, upgrading to Mankind 2.0. But that poor naive bastard was convinced we were screwing with the natural order, whatever the hell that means. When no one backed his play, he went dark, completely off the grid. Until New York, that is. Son of a bitch contacted the Delta and tried to blow the op."
Tyler raised an eyebrow. "He told the Delta he was a clone?"
"Nah," Chad said. "Just gave him a vague warning we were watching him or some shit. Guess he planned to tell him the rest later. Break it to him easy that he was born and raised in a petri dish. Fortunately, we had eyes on the Delta. Our boys recognized Reed and took him out."
The elevator doors opened and they spilled out onto a marbled floor in a cavernous lobby. Footfalls and conversations echoed around them as they wove their way toward the front entrance. Granite pillars rose several stories toward the lobby ceiling, where a holographic projection of corporate's latest propaganda spun in a lazy circle. Antibiotics to combat the latest superbugs, artificial organs and tissue engineering upgrades, designer babies, extended lifespans, genetic augmentation. For Joe Public and the drones at Roman Biogenics, it was all theoretical. Only a select few knew about Project Phoenix, and fewer still were apprised of the details. All these people, a city of millions who lived and died and left behind a legacy of diddly shit. Stories forgotten, a stone cast into a pond, a ripple, and still waters. But Chad and his team, their actions would echo on. A black four-door Suburban waited for them curbside in the dying twilight. The Alpha clambered into the third row behind a wire mesh partition that separated him from the back seat, where Tyler sat. Chad slid into the passenger seat and swiped at his tablet, while Jensen squeezed in behind the wheel and bowled his way into traffic amid a blare of horns with the stolid grace of a glacier.
"Take the expressway toward Queens," Chad said, then continued his story. "Sam Harrington was the detective assigned to the investigation. Pain in the ass was what he was, like a goddamn pit bull. Wouldn't let go, even after we wrapped up the op.
And he's still breathing? Tyler asked. Why didn't the company just remove the threat?
We tried. A couple of times, actually. First time the Delta saved his ass. The second time was at his house. Son of a bitch had bigger balls than we gave him credit for. He fought off three of our agents, killed one of our best, guy named Randy Carlson. I'd known Randy since forever. We grew up together, went to the same college, served in the Marines together, too. Two tours in Mexico. I probably wouldn't have made it through that shitstorm in one piece if it hadn't been for Randy. And when I got out and joined the company, he came with me. He was the closest thing I had to family, and Harrington just snuffed him out. I swore to God if I got the chance, I'd pay him back. Instead of killing Harrington, I'd take his family from him and see how he liked them apples. But, hey, I'm not completely heartless, and killing his wife and kid wouldn't have solved anything. So instead, we set him up. It wasn't hard. Poor bastard was already coming apart at the seams. He spent just about every night in some bar or another, and on this particular occasion, he'd gotten three sheets to the wind with no help from anyone. We slipped him a little Rohypnol and gave him the night of his life. Sex, drugs, rock and roll. Good old Detective Harrington partied like a porn star. Then we placed an anonymous call to the cops, and they busted him. He lost all credibility, along with his job, his family, pretty much everything.
So now he's motivated, Tyler said.
Chad shrugged. He's just one guy.
At the intersection of Bowery and East Houston Street, the holographic traffic signal winked from green to yellow. The car in front of them sped through the intersection, and Jensen brought the Suburban to a stop at the crosswalk as the hologram turned red. A crowd of pedestrians surged across their path.
They scurry like sedated beetles, the Alpha said with a low chuckle.
He sat with his fingers laced through the latticework of the partition, forehead pressed to the wire mesh. His eyes gleamed. Imagine driving into them. Their insectile cries, the crunch of their bones like carapaces beneath the heel of the boot. Chad tapped at the digital wristband Bernd Haefler gave him in the lab. The Alpha's graphene choker constricted, and he gagged and fell back in his seat, clawing at his neck.
Keep your mouth shut, Chad said. Do as you're told, and we can all live happily ever after when this is over. Capiche?
The Alpha nodded frantically. His face had turned a curious shade of plum wine. Chad tapped again. The choker loosened, and the Alpha gulped for air like a bass out of water. His eyes burned with fury, but he remained silent. The light turned green, and Jensen accelerated through the intersection. Chad returned his attention to his tablet and frowned.
Echo 7 is on the move, he said. Headed in our direction. I'm guessing he's got Harrington in tow. Pull over until I figure out where they're going.
Jensen eased the Suburban to the curb. Chad tracked Echo 7, and presumably Harrington, as they took the expressway in the Queens Midtown Tunnel to Manhattan and turned onto West 42nd Street.
Huh, Chad said.
What is it? Tyler asked. She leaned forward and peered over his shoulder at the screen.
They're headed toward the west side. Maybe Harrington will do us a solid, pay a visit to his former colleagues at the Midtown North Precinct and end this cat-and-mouse bullshit. But I doubt it. Probably going to somewhere in Chelsea or Hell's Kitchen, fuck if I know. Could be anywhere. It doesn't matter, though. There's nowhere they can hide that we can't find them. It's only a matter of time before this is over.
Gunfire belted out of Island Harmony, and whoever was dragging him let out a choked cry and staggered away. He fell into the mud. The back of his helmet slammed into the ground, and the front tilted over his vision. He reached with his left hand to push it out of the way, but his left hand was gone, replaced by a bloody stump of meat and bone that hung in tatters like a war-weary flag. He moaned and squeezed his eyes shut. A cannonade of vertigo rolled over him in waves, and he turned his head and retched.
A thin line of saliva swayed from the corner of his mouth and distended into the mud as it mixed with the falling rain. Sean Jaffe jerked in his seat, and the sounds of combat and the jungle morphed into the bleat of horns and the rumble of the Cadillac's engine. His heart hammered in his chest, and he let out a shaky breath. Tucked into the waistband of his jeans, his pistol pressed into the small of his back like a reassuring hand. Harrington glanced at him. "You okay?" They rolled to a stop as the holographic traffic signal stretching across the road turned red. Harrington said something else, but the words were muffled and unintelligible. A wilted newsstand sagged near the corner of the intersection. Above its shelves of sodas and candy bars, racks of magazines and newspapers hung in rows, both digital and paper editions, lit by a soft fluorescent glow. A fossil of a man slumped behind the counter and picked at his fingernails. He didn't know how long he lay there. Forever, maybe, bleeding out onto the jungle floor. The angry chatter of gunfire faded, replaced by the soft patter of rain on leaves and the chirp of cicadas. He wanted to tell his daughter how much he loved her and how proud he was of her. He wanted to tell his wife she was the best thing that ever happened to him. But mostly, he wanted to die. A shadow detached itself from the darkness and stretched over him like an epilogue. The barrel of a rifle lifted the brim of his helmet, and he stared into the face of the enemy. The Viet Cong said nothing and pointed the barrel into his face and pulled the trigger. "Sean!" Sean blinked and furrowed his brow. His door was open. He'd swung a leg out and hauled himself out of the car with no recollection of any of it.
"What are you doing?" Harrington asked.
Sean fell back into his seat and slammed his door shut.
"I don't know. Getting a newspaper."
The Cadillac started forward again, and he bit back a rising panic as the newsstand slipped by and disappeared behind them. "A newspaper." The detective rolled the word on his tongue, savoring it like an after-dinner mint. Sean glanced over his shoulder.
"I think it's how they control me," he said. "How they give me missions or instructions or whatever you want to call it. Do you remember when we first met at the Café Del Mar? I was reading the Times. And later that night, they delivered a hard copy to my apartment."
Harrington nodded. "We found it open to the classifieds," he said. "There was an ad that only existed in your copy. It was a quote from Shakespeare and a telephone number. And someone from that number sent you a text with blueprints to Madison Square Garden. Do you remember what happened after that?"
The dream in Amarillo that had been on his lips when he'd awoke. "Don't."
He'd been about to say, "Don't shoot." "You killed a man," Harrington said. "A senator."
"And then I killed myself," Sean said. His voice was soft and ragged, like frayed silk.
Harrington scratched at his beard. "I got a feeling if you turn to the classifieds, you'll find another ad. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but someday, soon. And it'll be Shakespeare and a phone number all over again."
"But I died. How do you explain that? I shot myself and I died."
"I have no idea. I wish I did, I really do, because it scares the hell out of me."
The city loomed before them like a mythical labyrinth. Colors and lights stretched into the darkening sky and faded into the heavens.
"I'm having these visions."
Sean stared out the window as he spoke.
"I had one just now. I had them earlier, too, when I stopped at the hotel."
"What kind of visions?"
"I'm in a jungle. It's during the Vietnam War. Don't ask how I know that, I just do. But I don't know if these are memories they gave me or if I'm going crazy or what. But it's bad. I black out."
"Well," Harrington said, "I guess it's a good thing I'm driving."
Sean stared at him. The corner of Harrington's mouth twitched. He broke into a grin, started to chuckle, and Sean couldn't help but join in.
Soon the two of them were laughing like a pair of mad hatters. When they'd gotten a hold of themselves, Sean wiped at his eyes. "But if they can just put an ad in the classifieds, why come after me?" he asked. "Why not sit back and wait for me to finish the job for them?" Harrington furrowed his brow and stroked his beard again.
"Maybe it's because they don't know which city you'll stop in or which newspaper you'll read. Hell, even if you stopped somewhere for a while, you're remembering shit you're not supposed to. They're probably afraid that the newspaper trick won't work anymore. And if in the meantime you remember your next mission or who did this to you, forget about it."
Sean leaned his head back and sighed. He said, "It all sounds so crazy."
"You got a better theory?" Harrington asked. "Look, Lark Morton, where you worked, I paid them a visit after you disappeared. They'd closed up shop. I'm talking the place was a ghost town. The entire floor empty. And when I tried to figure out where they went, I got zilch. No tax records, no filings, not even a goddamn website. Like they never existed."
"That's impossible," Jaffe said. Harrington ignored him.
"You had cardboard boxes in your apartment. What was in them?"
Sean shrugged. "Some stuff from my mom and dad's, pictures, crap from school, clothes, stuff like that. Just memories."
"Memories." Harrington nodded. "I like that, because those boxes were filled with bricks, old magazines, junk. Nothing but trash. Nothing real."
"That's..."
Harrington cut him off. "Impossible? You want to know what's impossible? They erased you. You vanished as easily as footprints in the sand. No records, no social networking profiles, no online purchases, nothing. Remember what that guy at the restaurant said? He said, 'You're not Sean Jaffe, you're not from Ohio, and you're not an investment broker.' You say it sounds crazy. I say, fuck yeah, it sounds crazy. But that's how it is."
The horizon burned with the dying embers of sunset. The Cadillac's headlights cut through the twilight, and the city stretched before them like a flawed jewel.
"So what do we do?" Sean asked.
"I'm gonna make some phone calls. Then we'll go somewhere nice and public and wait."
"Where?"
The detective grinned at him.
"I hear the Café Del Mar has a mean tapas bar."
Chapter 7 Chad Dodd zoomed in and squinted at the tablet, his expression that of a man puzzling through the punchline of an obscure joke. At last he shook his head and laughed.
Emma cocked an eyebrow. "What is it?"
"They're at the Café Del Mar. That's where Gary Reed got himself killed trying to warn the Delta, and Harrington entered the picture. The man's got one hell of a sense of irony. I guess it's poetic or something, making his last stand where all this started. Must think he's safe with an audience."
Dodd gave Jensen the address. They stopped a couple of blocks away, and Emma piled out of the Suburban with Dodd and the Alpha, while Jensen programmed directions for the nearest parking garage into the navigation system. His expression remained impassive to the horns and obscenities shouted from the vehicle stacking up behind him as he unfolded himself from the cab and eased the door shut, and the Suburban rolled off into the night. They forged their way along the sidewalk beneath a halo of streetlights and holo signs that glowed fiery red, dark blue, and the yellow orange of sulfur.
"How do you want to handle this?" Emma asked.
"Let me do the talking," Dodd said. "I'll lay it out for them. Once Harrington finds out what his pal is, I'm hoping he'll see the light."
"And if he doesn't?"
Dodd shrugged.
"Either way, Harrington is coming with us. No loose ends this time." He peered at Jensen. "If he tries to resist, you're up to bat. Non-lethal force. If we can, let's avoid a scene. Make it look legit."
Jensen nodded. The press of bodies had thinned with the setting of the sun, and the few who remained gave his lumbering gait a wide berth.
Dodd went on. "Tyler, if things get hot, try to defuse the situation. Some part of him remembers you as his wife, so work that. The Alpha's a last resort. We only put him in play if Echo 7 throws down or tries to run. He turned to the Alpha. You understand?
But the Alpha had fallen behind them. He paced a young woman in a sundress and denim jacket who was hand in hand with a little tow-headed girl in pigtails. He peered at the child with a wordless stare. The woman wrapped an arm around the child and increased her stride, but he matched it. She regarded him with wide, fearful eyes.
What's your problem, creep?
Oh, for Christ's sake.
Dodd's face clenched like a fist.
Hey!
He raised his forearm, a finger poised over the wristband. The Alpha froze and raised his hands in mock surrender. The young woman and the little girl hurried past, the woman tossing an anxious glance over her shoulder.
Last goddamn warning, Dodd said. Next time, you're done.
There won't be a next time, the Alpha said in a low, malefic tone. The words hung in the air like an ominous pall.
Emma half expected Dodd to do it. A tap of the wristband and the Alpha would crumple to the pavement as his head rolled into the gutter. But instead, Dodd spun on his heels and strode off, and they fell in behind him. It was probably for the best. If Echo 7 fought back, they had no chance without the Alpha. Yet a terrible foreboding gripped Emma. He was a loose cannon with a lit fuse waiting to go off. Nevertheless, she said nothing. Later, she'd wish she had. Although the dinner crowd had come and gone, the diehard night owls still filled over half the tables at the Café Del Mar, sipping cocktails and picking at their meals. The atmosphere was dark and smoky, like fine rum. The nightclub on the second floor thumped with a muffled bass and sent a subtle sway through the chandeliers that hung from the ceiling. Their lights glittered like constellations in flux. An olive-skinned maitre d' with slicked-back onyx hair greeted Sean and Harrington at the door. His gaze flitted over their jeans and rumpled T-shirts, and he wrinkled his nose and adjusted his tie.
Buenos tardes, señores. How may I help you?
He forced a smile.
Table for two, Harrington said.
The maitre d' frowned but scooped up a pair of leather-bound menus off a stand.
Of course. Right this way.
He led them to a table nestled in the back of the restaurant. It was perfect. They had an unobstructed view of the entire dining area. Sean slid into his seat and Harrington sat diagonally to his right. The maitre d' placed the menus in front of them.
Your server will be with you shortly, he said, and spun on his heels and glided back to his post.
Harrington brushed at a stain on his shirt and frowned.
You think I'm underdressed?
Sean shot him a nervous smile, fidgeted with the napkin and silverware, and nodded his hands in his lap. His gaze darted about the room like an erratic heartbeat, moving from face to face before returning to the entrance.
Relax, Harrington said. They won't try anything. It's too public. We're safe until my guys get here.
Sean wished he could believe that. The front door swung open and Sean's breath caught in his throat, but it was only an entourage of well-dressed 20-somethings who wound their way to the rear of the restaurant and the stairs that led to the nightclub. Most of the crowd were suits and skirts throwing a few back amid raucous laughter after a day at the office. A scattering of couples sat hand in hand and leaned toward each other at a phototropic slant, eyes locked, heads bent in conspiratorial whispers. The soft murmur of conversation and clink of cutlery mingled with the aroma of Spanish spices, and the contradictory banality of it set his already precarious state of mind into a tailspin. So when the front door swung open again, and a man with a blonde crew cut and dressed in cargo pants pushed his way through the front door of the restaurant, Sean's heart leapt into his throat, bucking and kicking like a wild Mustang. Crewcut was tall, but nothing compared to the mountain that lumbered in behind him, with a neck of a bull and biceps that strained at his sleeves like gorged pythons. Victoria glided in after them, her long, shining black hair flowing down her back like she'd stepped out of a Vidal Sassoon commercial.
They found us,
Sean said. Crewcut locked in on them and veered toward their table. That's when the final member of the team came into view, and Sean's world collapsed like a house of cards. His hair was longer, parted in the middle and hanging to his shoulders in unkempt strands, and he moved with an unfamiliar, languid swagger. But his face was the reflection that stared back at Sean from the surface of mirrors and still waters everywhere. This other Sean Jaffe bared his teeth in a wicked grin. "My God," Harrington gasped. As they approached the table, the doppelganger quickened his pace and slipped in front of the others. Crewcut's eyes widened with alarm and he raised an arm to stop him, but Sean's doppelganger stepped around it with an easy grace. He spun the chair across from Sean around and sat straddling it, arms folded over the back. "Hello, me," he said. "How have I been?" He regarded Sean with a cold, flat expression and cocked his head to one side.
"You mind?"
Crewcut said. He and the giant shifted the empty chairs around and shoved one of the adjacent tables so it abutted Sean's and the detective's. The maitre d' hurried toward them, his expression grave and none too happy. "Por favor, I'll seat you at a larger table." The giant's arms crossed and he stepped into the man's path. The maitre d' skidded to a halt.
"Thanks, we're good," Crewcut said.
He and Victoria slid into chairs alongside Sean's doppelganger. The maitre d' shifted his feet and blinked at them. At last he sniffed and stalked back to his station at the front door. The giant remained between them and the exit. Crewcut turned to Harrington.
"We need to talk, Sam."
Harrington whirled from Sean to his lookalike and back again.
"What the hell is this?"
"Just a conversation."
"What the hell is this? He has a twin?"
"Something like that."
Sean gawked at the skewed mirror seated across from him. Impossible, yet the proof literally stared him in the eye. Harrington shot him a look that was equal parts bewilderment and suspicion. Sean shook his head.
"I have no idea."
Harrington turned to Crewcut.
"But you do," he said.
"Of course," said Crewcut.
"Then start talking."
But before he could, the giant said,
"We got company."
Chad Dodd twisted in his seat and craned toward the entrance. Two men, one rotund and damn near bursting the buttons of his dark suit, the other athletic, black-haired and much younger, brushed past the maitre d'. They ignored his greeting and angled toward the retinue seated at the tables. The maitre d's shoulders slumped and he hung his head. If he had a towel, he'd have thrown it in. Jensen stepped into their path, and the rotund suit flashed a badge.
"Detective Nat Francis, NYPD, he said. "This is Detective Ethan Mooney."
He jabbed a thumb over his shoulder at the younger man. Jensen glanced at Chad and raised an eyebrow, and Chad gave a slight nod. Jensen stepped aside, and the two detectives converged on the table.
"Harrington," Francis said with a tip of his chin. "Long time no see. How's life?"
"It goes on."
Francis did a double take at the Alpha and Echo 7.
"Who's the Weasley twins?"
Harrington cocked his head at Echo 7.
"This one's Sean Jaffe."
"No shit, huh?" Francis said. "Back from the dead. How's that work?"
Harrington shrugged.
"What about George over there?"
"I don't know." He glanced at Chad. "But I think he might."
"Is that so?" Francis asked.
Mooney reached inside his blazer and came out with a small handheld electronic device that resembled an old-fashioned radio. Chad frowned.
"What the hell are you doing?"
Mooney waved the device over Echo 7 like a divining rod, sweeping for bugs.
"Sir," Francis said, "I'm going to need you and your friends to come with us to the station. We need to ask you a few questions."
"Stop," Chad said to Mooney.
Mooney chuckled.
"Fat chance, pal." "Maybe you're hard of hearing,"
Francis leaned into Chad's face. His breath reeked of yesterday's coffee.
We can do this the easy way or the hard way. But between you and me, I hope we do it the hard way. I'll ask you one more time. I'll even do it real nice. Wipe that smug look off your fucking face. Get your ass out of that chair and come with me, please.
Chad pulled an ID card out of his jacket and held it out to Francis.
How's this for smug?
Francis stared as if it had teeth and took it. He frowned and his face darkened like thunderclouds rolling in. Meanwhile, Mooney passed the bug detector over the nape of Echo 7's neck. Its LED lights glowed red, and it let out a squawk.
Gotcha, he said. Well, detective?
Chad raised an eyebrow at Francis. You hear that, Francis? I found the bug. Francis chewed on his bottom lip, inspected the ID, and said nothing. What's wrong? Mooney asked.
There's one smart move here, detective, Chad said.
Mooney glared at Chad. To Francis, he said, We're bringing them in, right? Francis slumped like a sail in a calm wind.
Chad said, Fat chance.
He smiled.
Pal.
What is it? Sam Harrington asked.
Francis peered at him with mournful eyes. Coupled with his loose jowls, it gave him the countenance of a basset hound.
Sorry, Harrington.
Let me see.
Sam held out his hand, and Francis pressed the ID into his palm. It was clear plastic, embedded with microcircuitry, and embossed with the seal of the U.S. Department of Commerce. Beneath an unsmiling photo of Crewcut was his name, Dodd, Chad Nicholas, and the card identified him as Chief of Operations for Roman Biogenics. A yellow stripe with black letters that repeated, Executive Privilege, Corporate Immunity, bordered its edges like police tape. Corporate conglomerates had all but stomped out independent business decades ago. From there, they moved on to co-opting the government, and in time, the majority of the U.S. Congress shifted from Democrats and Republicans to board members. But Thomas Hoyt was the first corporate lackey elected president, and the Executive Incorporation Act was his baby. It authorized the merger of the Department of Commerce and five of the largest corporations in the United States. It also gave their leadership full executive privilege and corporate immunity. Roman Biogenics was one of those five. In other words, Chad Dodd was operating under the legitimate authority of the United States government and had the clout of the president in his corner. Dodd blinked at Francis.
So we good?
Don't tell me we're going to let this prick walk, Mooney said. Francis shook his head.
We got no choice.
This is some bullshit right here.
If you don't mind, gentlemen.
Dodd nodded toward the door.
Oh, hell no, Mooney said. I ain't going nowhere.
They stared at each other like gunslingers in a spaghetti western. Dodd narrowed his eyes.
I can have your badges so fast your heads will spin.
Forget about it, Sam said. You guys did your best. I owe you one.
He laid the ID on the table and pushed it toward Dodd.
This ain't right, Mooney said, shaking his head.
Francis put a hand on his shoulder.
Come on, let's go.
You know this ain't right.
I know. Good luck, Sam.
The two detectives made their way toward the exit. Mooney shot a final smoldering look over his shoulder, and the door swung shut behind them. Sam glanced at the lookalike seated across from Jaffe and turned back to Dodd.
Roman Biogenics, he said.
Dodd shrugged.
Big surprise. You already knew.
Sam blinked and clenched his jaw.
You set me up.
What do you expect, a round of applause? You fucked with the wrong hombres, detective.
We're not twins, are we? Jaffe asked. His gaze never left his double seated across from him.
No, Dodd said. You're not.
I'd almost convinced myself we were cybernetic, androids, cyborgs, or something like that. It'd explain how I'd survived a bullet to the head. But Roman Biogenics doesn't do robotics. Your forte is pharmaceuticals, medical drugs, genetic augmentation, isn't it? Dodd said nothing. We're not twins, and we're not androids, Jaffe said. We're clones.
Well, give the man a cigar, Dodd said, grinning. He jabbed a thumb at Jaffe's double. This one is the Alpha. Our first success.
The Alpha bowed his head and crossed himself. So man created man in his own image, he said solemnly. And God saw what man had made, and behold, God wept for him. And the evening and the morning were the eighth day. Dodd ignored him and continued.
We cloned the Alpha from the original specimen, he said. He's genetically enhanced, of course, faster and stronger than anyone else alive. Unfortunately, his social skills were somewhat lacking, so we shelved him. We cloned follow-on iterations from the original specimen as well, but the Bravo and Charlie had deficiencies similar to the Alpha. It wasn't until the Delta that we perfected humanity in all its glorious flaws and insecurities and loosed him on the world. That was New York.
So I'm the Delta, Jaffe said.
What? No. You think you somehow survived a bullet to the head? Don't be ridiculous. The Delta is dead.
You're lying. How do I remember what happened in New York?
Because instead of using the original specimen, Dodd said, we cloned the Echo from the Delta. An iterative process. It was much easier. You were cloned from a clone, but in the process you retained the Delta's memories.
Jaffe gaped at him.
What? I know, Dodd said. It's fascinating, isn't it? Means our consciousness is somehow stored at the genetic level. What if someone in this room is descended from Aristotle and has his memoirs encoded in their DNA? Or Napoleon? Or Jesus?
That's insane, Sean said. The words cracked like deadwood.
Is it? Maybe. But it's also a nut we're paying a lot of money to crack.
Dodd sighed. But the bitch of it is, we didn't just create an Echo, but a generation of them.
16, to be exact. You are Echo 7.
Wait a minute, Sam cut in. You mean there's more of them?
Dodd nodded. Exactly. But unfortunately, the other Echoes have the same problem. They all share memories with the Delta.
What'll happen to them? Jaffe asked.
Dodd shrugged. It's not a complete waste. We'll use them for research.
But they're still people, Jaffe said.
People? Dodd snorted. You're not a person. You're no one, a creation without a soul. You think your name is Sean Jaffe? Ryan Marshall? You don't have a name. We grew you in a lab, and the first day of your life began when you woke in Amarillo. Everything you remember never happened.
That's why more city seemed off, isn't it? It's why the home I remembered didn't match reality.
Dodd nodded. Cobbled together memories. It's not perfect, but it's good enough until you start peeling the onion.
Jaffe turned to the raven-haired woman. Was any of it real?
She lowered her gaze.
Your name isn't even Victoria, is it?
She didn't reply. The Alpha chuckled and, in a sing-song voice, said, Awkward.
Why are you telling us this? Sam Harrington interjected.
Dodd folded his hands on the table and met his gaze with a look that was as steady as Zen.
Because I want your help, Sam.
You're kidding, right?
This isn't Sean Jaffe. You owe him nothing. He's just a clone.
Dodd lowered his voice.
He's also dangerous, like you would not believe.
Genetic augmentation. This is the prototype that got you your defense contract.
Dodd smiled.
I like you. You're smart. That's why I want to make you an offer.
Sam started to respond, but the Alpha leaned forward, his hands on the table and fingers splayed like talons.
Have the visions started yet? He asked Jaffe.
Jaffe jerked back in his seat as if the words were a right cross to the jaw, his eyes wide and mouth hanging open.
Our daughter. The war in the jungle, the Alpha said. You're having them too.
Yes. Jaffe exhaled the word like the final breath of a dying man.
Memories from the father, the true Alpha. He is us, and we are him.
Dodd knit his brow.
The hell does that mean?
The Alpha glared at him from beneath his bangs.
Every story has a beginning.
The visions are Vietnam, Jaffe interrupted. Some kind of battle. There's a grenade. We're overrun. He shook his head and fell silent.
Sam said, You said he remembered New York because you cloned him from the Delta. What if this is the same thing? Whose DNA did you start with? Who was the original specimen?
He died in Vietnam.
Dodd stared and nodded.
You're right. These visions, their memories. Amazing.
When the grenade went off, it took off our hand. The Alpha raised a fist. Poof. Blood and bone and gristle. Do you have any idea what that felt like?
He didn't wait for a response. He leapt into action at a fast forward speed, reached for his napkin-wrapped silverware, tore it free with a flourish. The steak knife materialized in his hand. The napkin flew into the air like a white dove. He stood and slammed the blade into Dodd's wrist. It blurred as it sawed through flesh and tendon in a spray of crimson. The blade severed Dodd's hand and thunked to the table. Its handle snapped off. The napkin fluttered toward the floor. Dodd screamed and jerked his arm backward. His severed hand remained on the table like an obscene insect, and his bracelet slid off his wrist. He cradled the ragged stump to his chest. Conversations at other tables in the restaurant came to an abrupt and violent end. Heads turned. Sam's heartbeat thundered like a coming storm. A woman shrieked.
I guess you do, the Alpha said.
Oh my God,
someone cried out. Sam pushed his chair back and rose to his feet. He yanked his pistol from the waistband of his jeans. The Alpha held the broken knife handle, a splatter of red across his brow and face. Sam leveled the gun at him. The Alpha shoved Dodd, who toppled out of his chair and fell to the ground. As he fell, the Alpha reached into his jacket and took his pistol. Sam aimed. Too late. The Alpha was already aiming back and squeezed the trigger. The shot hit him in the head. Pain bloomed like a raging inferno. Sam staggered back into a table. It caught him behind the thighs. His legs gave out and he collapsed onto it. The table tipped over and spilled him onto the floor. He crashed to the ground with a grunt. Darkness washed over him. Sam struggled toward the surface, but a cold undercurrent tugged at him and pulled him under. From somewhere far away drifted cries of panic. He reached for them like a man reaching for a life buoy. No use. He was so tired. Sam took a deep, shuddering breath and let it out in a slow exhale that seemed to go on for eternity. The Alpha pulled the trigger, and the silenced pistol spit a muffled report. As Harrington fell, chaos swirled through the restaurant like a tempest. Its patrons rose in a scrape of chairs and stampeded for the exits. They knocked aside tables and each other, shrieking and hollering in a mad trample to escape. Several careened off the giant like waves battering against an unmovable rock cliff. The giant reached into his jacket and tore his pistol from its holster. Next to the Alpha, Victoria fumbled with her own holster. Dodd lay on the floor and leaked blood and moaned. Sean's first instinct was for Harrington, but the Alpha turned his gun on the giant.
If he missed, or if the bullet passed through the man, it would hit someone in the crowd behind him, an innocent bystander with a family and a future. Sean leapt to his feet, seized the Alpha's wrist, and forced the barrel down. It bucked and spit. A gouge of wood splintered the floor. The Alpha shoved him sideways. The giant fired, and the shot went wide. The Alpha lifted a knee, pistoned his leg forward, and drove the sole of his foot into Sean's chest. The force of the blow catapulted him backward. He went airborne. Tables and chairs passed beneath him as he flew across the room. He crashed into the wall. It caved with a cloud of plaster and dust. He rebounded off it and fell onto a table that gave way beneath him with a series of sharp cracks, and he crumpled to the floor in a heap amid its remains. Emma Tyler unsnapped her holster. Its leather creaked like an old saddle. Echo 7 leapt at the Alpha, and Dodd's gun discharged into the floor with a crack of wood. Jensen fired at them and missed. The Alpha kicked Echo 7 and sent him flying across the room like a rag doll. Echo 7 hit the wall, and it imploded with a crash. Jensen fired again, and again, but each time he pulled the trigger, the Alpha twisted his upper body to the side. He bared his teeth in a humorless rictus, a parody of a grin. He was dodging the bullets. Emma drew her pistol and pointed it at the side of the Alpha's head, at point-blank range. But before she could squeeze the trigger, his arm lashed out, and he closed his hand over the top of the gun. His thumb flicked at the side stop, and the slide separated from the weapon's frame. He swung the steel in a backhand. It caught her on the jaw and knocked her sideways. A nova of white light exploded in her head. She fell onto her hands and knees, her hair hanging in her face. Jensen squared off at the Alpha, pistol held in both hands, and squeezed off a volley of shots. The Alpha advanced toward him, as relentless as the tide, as he jerked left and right with each pull of the trigger. The restaurant's patrons continued to surge toward the exit, a swell of bodies all shoving and fighting to get through the doorway at once. A few stayed, huddled beneath the maelstrom of disarrayed tables and chairs, unwilling to brave the hail of bullets overhead. Music and bass reverberated through the ceiling, where muffled revelry continued to echo from the nightclub, oblivious to the menace below. Dodd pushed himself into an awkward sitting position, his pants soggy with the blood that spread around him in a black pool. He'd removed his belt and struggled to loop it over the ragged stump of his wrist in a crude tourniquet. With one hand, he had a hell of a time of it. Emma crawled toward him. Dodd guided the belt into the buckle, clamped the free end between his teeth, and cinched the leather around his forearm. He waved her off as she approached.
"Find the bracelet!"
He gritted the words through his clenched jaw.
"We have to stop him!"
Emma nodded and searched the floor, peering through the forest of chairs and table legs. She spotted it 7 or 8 feet away, opposite Dodd. It lay in a spatter of red, like bloody tears. Jensen continued to pull the trigger until the hammer fell on an empty chamber with a dull click. He tossed it aside and swung a fist at the Alpha. The Alpha slipped past the blow as easily as if he ducked beneath a low-hanging branch. He jammed the barrel of his gun into Jensen's belly and fired twice. Jensen grunted and his legs buckled beneath him. But the Alpha grabbed the larger man by the neck and held him on his feet. Jensen gagged and his eyes bulged. One hand clutched at his gut and the other fought to peel the Alpha's hand away. But the grip was a vice. "Look at me," the Alpha said. "I want to watch you die. I want to see what you see." He leaned forward and pressed the barrel of the pistol against the side of Jensen's head and pulled the trigger. Brains and gore sprayed outward. Jensen collapsed, a lifeless tangle of limbs. Emma scrabbled around Dodd. The overhead lights and chandeliers reflected in his pooled blood and shimmered like will-o'-the-wisps. She reached for the bracelet. The Alpha stomped on her hand. The bones crunched like glass. She gasped in pain. A heartbeat ago, he stood over Jensen, Now he leered at her from behind the barrel of his gun and wagged a finger at her. He ground his heel into the back of her hand. She screamed and writhed on the floor. He bent, seized the bracelet, and tossed it across the room. He aimed and fired. The bracelet exploded in a twist of rubber and circuitry and clattered to the ground in pieces. Dodd glared at the Alpha.
You think that matters? They can activate your necklace from anywhere, anytime. When they figure out you went rogue, you're dead.
But I didn't go rogue, the Alpha said. I carried out my orders, completed my mission, and reported back to Roman Biogenics. Too bad Echo 7 killed all of you first. He shrugged. That made me sad.
No one's going to believe you.
Sure they will. Hey, I can even say I gave you a hand. The Alpha plucked Dodd's severed hand from the table and tossed it at him. It bounced off his face, and Dodd jerked back in revulsion. The hand skidded across the floor and rolled to a stop, palm up, fingers curled like a dead cockroach. Dodd stared at it.
I'll see you in hell, he said.
It's a date. The Alpha smiled and squeezed the trigger. The silenced shot snapped the air. Dodd went limp and toppled backward. His head thumped against the floor, his unblinking eyes fixed on the ceiling. His severed stump slipped free of its tourniquet and leaked a weak stream of scarlet, like spilled wine. The Alpha's weight eased off Emma's hand. She pulled it free and crawled toward Harrington's limp form. His pistol lay beside him and glinted in the pale light like an absolution. She focused her resolve on reaching the gun and pushed the pain of her shattered hand into a dark corner of her mind. Where are you going? The Alpha grabbed her by the ankle and hauled her back. She flailed for purchase with her good hand as she slid across the floor. When he released her, Emma crawled toward the pistol again. He stepped forward and kicked her in the ribs. She cried out and curled in on herself, but he shoved his foot into her shoulder and forced her onto her back. She withered before the black and gaping maw of the pistol's barrel, and her heart stuttered in her throat. She squeezed her eyes shut and waited for the end. Sean Jaffe opened his eyes and shook his head to clear it. He lay in a ruin of fractured tables and chairs. Their splintered remains poked up around him like punji sticks. He clambered out of the debris, brushed at his clothes, ran a hand over his face and through his hair. A cloud of plaster billowed around him like the dust of ancient civilizations. He took stock of his injuries. Nothing broken, no cuts or bruises, no pain. Genetic augmentation, Sam Harrington had said. This is the prototype that got you your defense contract. The muted pop of a silenced gunshot rang out. Dodd went limp and slumped to the ground like a wet rag. Victoria tried to crawl away, but the Alpha grabbed her by the ankle and yanked her back. When she tried again, he kicked her in the side and leveled his gun at her. They were halfway across the room, too far to cover. He reached for the pistol tucked into his jeans at the small of his back, but he'd never draw in time. Hey, he called out. The Alpha swung the pistol toward Sean. As with a van hit and run at the morgue and the shootout in Amarillo, time seemed to dilate, and each moment stretched into the next like an infinite parade of stars. Sean visualized the trajectory of the bullet. The muscles in the Alpha's forearm flexed, and his fingers squeezed the trigger. Sean shifted to the right. The gun bucked and barked, and the bullet whistled past his ear. The barrel tracked his movement. He ducked in the opposite direction as the Alpha fired again. Sean forged ahead and courted the hail of lead as the Alpha continued to fire, but each shot failed to find its target. In a knot of frustration, the Alpha turned the pistol on Victoria, but Sean had drawn his own gun. He aimed and fired. The others had fired with silenced weapons, but his roared like a lion gone mad. The impact ripped the pistol out of the Alpha's hand. It spun through the air, clattered across the room, and wedged itself in shadow beneath a confusion of overturned tables. Sean pulled the trigger again, but the Alpha dodged the shot. He slipped and sidestepped as Sean fired, and they advanced toward one another, gaining speed like a pair of runaway trains on the same track. Sean emptied the magazine and threw the pistol at the Alpha, who batted it aside without missing a step. Sean lowered his shoulder and caught the Alpha in the midsection as they collided. The Alpha staggered back several steps, planted his feet, and hammered his fists into Sean's back. Sean grunted and dropped to a knee. The Alpha's next blow hit him on the side of the head, and Sean sprawled sideways and tumbled across the floor. He scrambled to his feet and launched himself at the Alpha, who dropped into a crouch, and Sean groped at empty air as he flew over him. The Alpha slammed into his legs and sent him ass over heels. He flipped through the air like a coin. The ceiling and floor alternated like red and black pockets of a roulette wheel, and he bowled into a cluster of chairs and set them asunder. The pain was monstrous, but faded to a blunt itch as flesh and bone mended with unnatural speed. During their melee, Victoria must have made her way to Harrington's gun. Now she rose on her knees and took awkward aim with her left hand, her other a broken shatter of bone. The Alpha caught sight of her at the last second. He lurched out of the way as the gun boomed. Victoria steadied the weapon on her forearm and squeezed off a rapid succession of shots, but it was useless. The Alpha wove through the gunfire and stalked toward her with murder in his eyes. He grabbed a chair by its back and swung it sideways. It crashed into her and she sprawled onto her back. Sean sprang to his feet and charged. The Alpha ripped the gun out of her hand and tossed it aside. His lip curled into a sneer and he lifted a foot to stomp her face. She lay helpless and unmoving, unconscious or something worse. Sean slammed into the Alpha. They tumbled across the ground, bounced to their feet, and faced each other like coiled springs. The Alpha leered through his tangled mop of hair and attacked. His fists and feet blurred with each swing and kick. Sean staggered back under the ferocious assault. He blocked a hook with his forearm, slipped past a jab, and parried a kick. He countered with a side kick. The Alpha skipped out of range and leapt forward again. They glided across the room and swayed back and forth as if they were the last pair of a savage species on the foredeck of that storm-swept ark caught in a biblical flood. Sean's fist slipped past the Alpha's defenses and slammed into his mouth. The Alpha staggered back and curled his lips to reveal bleeding gums and rows of bloody teeth. He spat a wad of crimson and charged. A blow clipped Sean's shoulder and he winced and stumbled. A roundhouse kick hammered into his ribs. He folded in on himself like origami and dropped a hand to his side. The Alpha pounced. His fist drove into Sean's jaw like a wrecking ball, and Sean staggered and slumped to the ground. The Alpha twined a fist into his hair and slammed Sean's face into the floor, once, twice, three times. Sean moaned. Blood and spit dripped from his mouth and hung swinging like a pendulum. "Tell you what," the Alpha said. "After I kill you, I'm gonna kill your precious make-believe wife, those two detectives, and anyone else you cared about." The muscles in his neck strained as Sean fought the hand on the back of his head. "Come on. If you win, they're still going to kill you. There ain't no fairy tale ending for you, no matter how you spin it. I mean, talk about a buzzkill, right?" Sean struggled to his hands and knees. The Alpha clung to his back like a misshapen carapace and wrapped an arm around his neck in a chokehold. Sean gagged and peeled at the arm as he stumbled to his feet. The Alpha wrenched harder. Tiny pinpoints of light wove a blanket of darkness through the air. He staggered. "Say goodnight," the Alpha whispered in his ear.
"No."
Sean took a step forward, tucked a shoulder, and threw himself into a forward flip. He landed on his back and on the Alpha, who wheezed a burst of exhalation, and the arm around Sean's neck slipped free. He gasped for breath as he rolled over and struggled to his feet. His shattered jaw knit itself together like a worn quilt, and he flexed it from side to side. Sweat rolled down his face, and he wiped it with a shaky hand. It was up to him now. He was all that stood between this thing and the waiting world. He envisioned the Alpha snapping Victoria's neck, rifling through Sam Harrington's smartphone, finding evidence of his wife and son, paying them a visit. And after he finished them off, he'd go after the two detectives, Mooney and Francis. But it wouldn't end there. And as the bodies continued to pile up, even more good men and women would give their lives trying to bring him down. Only Sean could stop him. The Alpha clambered to his feet and brushed his hair back. He tossed his head with an arrogant insolence. Sean rushed him. He threw everything he had into it, rapid jabs and crosses mixed with wild haymakers and punctuated by a series of devastating kicks. The blows rained like a relentless monsoon, and the Alpha stumbled back under the onslaught. Sean wore away at his defenses like a Renaissance sculptor chiseling at marble. He clipped the Alpha's cheek with a hook and landed a glancing blow to his brow. Slipped a jab between the Alpha's forearms. The cartilage in his doppelganger's nose gave with a crunch. Sean followed it with a front kick to the stomach, and when the Alpha dropped his guard, Sean bounced back and exploded forward with an uppercut. It caught the man on the chin and lifted him off his feet. He crashed into a table. It crumpled into kindling. Sean strode at the Alpha, fists clenched, ready to finish the job. The Alpha rolled across the floor, scuttled into a four-point stance, and threw himself forward. The flash of metal came too late. The Alpha slammed into him. A monstrous pain tore into his chest. Sean staggered backward, eyes wide with disbelief. The handle of a steak knife slanted into his ribs to the right of his sternum. It pulsed in time with his telltale heart. Red bloomed like a field of poppies across his shirt. The Alpha's eyes blazed with triumph. "I win," he said. Sean grabbed the handle and wrenched the blade free. Agony washed over him like a cruel baptism. He fought it off with a primal roar, reversed his grip on the knife, and plunged it into the Alpha's chest. The Alpha's expression shifted from victory to astonishment, and he lurched and tried to pull away. But Sean shoved into him, and they fell. The Alpha landed on his back, and Sean straddled him. His heart struggled in his chest and limped along. The knife rose and fell, growing heavier with each ascent. Blood gushed from the Alpha's chest. He broke into wild gales of laughter that became a choked coughing fit and sprayed blood into the air. It leaked from his lips and flowed down his chin. "I still win," he cried, laughing and choking and coughing. "I am you, and you are me. I still win." Sean swung the knife a final time. It slid into the soft tissue of the Alpha's ear and embedded itself in his brain. The Alpha's heels drummed a staccato on the floor, until he finally lay still, his eyes empty and staring. Sean rolled off the Alpha. He lay on his back and closed his eyes. His heart beat, 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 stopped. Chapter 8. Beat. His heart beat, stuttered, and beat again. Sean Jaffe opened his eyes. Beneath the sodden mess of his torn shirt, his probing fingers found no evidence of the mortal wound that had pierced his flesh. The skin was unbroken. Not even a scar remained as testament. The music from the nightclub above had fallen mute, and silence descended like the red velvet of a theater curtain. Either they'd heard the gunshots and fled, or one of the restaurant's patrons had run upstairs for cover and warned them that bedlam was breaking out below. Sean struggled to his feet and staggered toward where Victoria lay on her back, limp and unmoving. He dropped to a knee and pressed two fingers to the side of her neck below the jaw. Her pulse beat strong and regular. "Vic..." He stopped and frowned. That wasn't her name. "Hey," he said instead and gave her shoulder a gentle shake. She groaned, cracked her eyes open. They flew wide and she tensed and sat up, flinching away from him. "I won't hurt you," he said. "Are you okay?" She studied his face for a moment before glancing down at her broken hand. "Hurts like hell, but I'm okay." Her gaze flickered to his bloody shirt. "My God, are you okay?"
"I'm fine."
She frowned and studied his shirt.
"That's a lot of blood."
"It's not all mine." Her eyes widened.
"The Alpha.
He's dead." She nodded and looked away.
"We were going to kill you."
"I know," he said.
"You could have walked away and let me die."
"No, I couldn't." She said nothing. The front doors of the restaurant flew open, and Detectives Nat Francis and Ethan Mooney burst into the room. Their drawn guns swept over the wreckage, and they fanned out through the remains of the restaurant's dining area. "Over here." Sean waved a hand and helped Victoria to her feet as Francis approached. Francis lowered his gun. "We got a call over the radio." "What the hell happened?" he asked. "Where's Harrington?"
"Found him," Mooney called out. "He's hit. Looks like it grazed his skull. He's unconscious but alive."
Sean reeled. "What? He's alive?" He started toward them, but Victoria put a hand on his arm. "We have to go," she said. He stared at her. She turned to Francis.
"Harrington was never here. He got shot trying to stop a mugging in Chelsea. Get him out of here, but don't let anyone see him. Take him to the emergency room."
Francis started to protest, but she cut him off.
"My authority and executive privilege still stands," she said. "Take Harrington and leave. Trust me, I'm doing him a favor."
Francis chewed on his lip.
"All right," he said. "You also need to evacuate the restaurant. Tell them there's a gas leak in the kitchen."
"Why?"
"Because there's about to be a gas leak in the kitchen," she said.
Francis nodded his chin at Sean.
"What happens to him?"
"The less you know, the better."
Francis turned from Sean to Harrington.
"He needs a doctor, bad," Mooney said, kneeling over the former detective.
Francis shrugged at Sean.
"Sorry, kid," he said.
"It's okay. Tell him I said thanks. For everything."
Victoria strode over to Dodd's corpse and plucked a digital tablet from inside his jacket with her unbroken hand.
"Come on," she said. "We'll go out the back."
Sean followed her through the swinging doors into the kitchen of the Café Del Mar. A familiar scene of silver-gray counters and cabinets greeted him. Meats and vegetables sizzled in stainless steel pans, the grease leaping and dancing in a splatter of tiny pirouettes, and stockpots filled with soups and sauces exuded a savory aroma that was as thick as the smoke and the steam drifting through the air. But this time, the chefs had fled the room, leaving their stations unattended, and no body lay on the floor. He and Victoria were alone.
"Why not let him kill me?" she asked.
She peered at him and tilted her head. Her hair hung like a silk shadow, and she brushed it back and tucked it behind one ear. He studied her face before answering.
"I have these memories of us. I know they're not real, but they're all I have." "I'm sorry," she said.
He tucked her hair behind her other ear.
"I couldn't let him hurt you."
A single tear slid down her cheek, and she wiped it away. "I'm done running," he said. "I'll do whatever you want, go wherever you ask. Just promise to leave Sam and the two detectives out of it."
She strained a smile. I'm not taking you in. I'm letting you go.
He stared at her.
She said, I'll disable your tracking device. Tell Roman Biogenics you died with the others in the restaurant. You can stop running.
Why?
She shrugged. Because I was wrong, and I'm sorry.
She fumbled a black palm-sized device out of her jacket.
This is a stun gun. I'll be honest, it's going to hurt like a mother, but we need to disable your tracker. I'll try to make it quick. Lie on your stomach.
Sean did. The tile was cool against his skin. She pressed the stun gun against the back of his neck. The electrodes made him shiver.
Ready?
She asked.
Ready,
he said.
He wasn't ready.
She pressed the trigger. Sean's muscles spasmed and locked. He tried to tell her to stop, enough, but his jaw clamped shut like a steel trap, and he twitched and shuddered on the ground as the electric current ripped through him. He moaned through clenched teeth. She switched the stun gun off, and he gasped for breath. A fan kicked on, and air rattled through the overhead vents. She cradled her broken hand against her body while she swiped at Dodd's tablet.
Signal lost, she said. It worked. Are you all right?
Sean sat up. Give me a second. While he collected himself, she eyed his blood-stained T-shirt.
You won't make it 10 feet looking like that, she said. Let's find you a change of clothes.
She searched a row of steel lockers and came out with a lightweight navy windbreaker. He shrugged it on and zipped it closed.
Fits, he said.
Not bad, she said.
At least you don't look like Jack the Ripper anymore.
He shrugged.
What now? Now you go. Live a good life. I'll take care of things here.
Sean hesitated and brushed her cheek with the backs of his fingers.
What's your name? He asked.
She gave him a sad smile and pressed his hand to her cheek before lowering it. But she still held it in her own.
Keep your head down. You're going to be fine.
Will I ever see you again? He asked. She squeezed his hand.
No.
He studied her face and tried to memorize her features. He turned and their fingers untwined and slipped apart as he strode toward the door in the rear of the kitchen. The words, fire exit, stenciled in red, had faded over the years, but they were still readable.
Sean, he turned toward her. Dodd was wrong. You're not just a clone. You're a person. You have a soul. A good soul. Don't ever forget that.
He pushed the crash bar and stepped outside. The door swung shut behind him. Two brick walls, pockmarked by windows, stood sentinel on either side of the alley where, a lifetime ago, an investment broker had chased a killer. A rusted fire escape wound its way across one wall like a scar. He walked away. She was right. He never saw her again. He stood on a beach, bathed in darkening shades of red and orange as the horizon swallowed the sun. A salty breeze tousled his hair. He ran a hand through his beard, its coarse hair still unfamiliar to him. The waves reached for him like vassals paying homage. They broke on the beach and glided over his feet before receding into the darkening ocean. He curled his toes in the sand and filled his lungs with the balm of the ocean and the city. In one hand, he held a worn and stained newspaper. He was an illusion, the rabbit in the hat, the quarter behind the ear, the severed rope made whole. His life was fiction, memories that never happened, and love of a woman he never knew. But he was alive and whole. He hadn't suffered a mother's womb, the joys of childhood, the angst of his teenage years. But a part of him was real. He had a soul. He clung to the truth of this as a man lost at sea clings to driftwood. In the grand scheme of things, he wasn't so different. Regular people with a past still remembered very little of it. They processed and stored their long-term memories in the left inferior prefrontal lobe, which didn't begin developing until the age of 3.
And after this age, only fragmented memories remained as a testament to those early years. A collage of remembrance and broken shards of the five senses stored in the brain as engrams. Even as adults, interests and needs filtered perception, and some memories were lost forever. The currents of time washed away these long-ago sights, smells, and sounds, leaving few experiences behind as proof of a past existence. What remained were snippets of a life that might have belonged to someone else. Amnesia was the standard condition of the human species. Even now, the memory of her face faded and would continue to fade until only a vague impression remained, like the carved rock of Rushmore's Roosevelt 1,000 years from now. But he remembered her voice as if it were yesterday.
"You have a soul, a good soul. Don't ever forget that." And it was his soul, not something created and grown in a lab. It defined him because it was real. His memories, however, were lies. Thus, he must unlearn his past, like a chalkboard wiped clean, because hidden behind the veil of consciousness, the face of another life waited, a life that belonged to someone long ago. He couldn't pick up where he left off like he was returning to an unfinished book. The pages were frail and crumbled beneath his touch. He had to write a new ending himself. The wind changed direction. A man approached, shuffling through the sand, and stopped beside him. They faced the horizon together, comfortable in the silence. In spite of their differences, in many ways they were the same. Two broken men with pasts they must escape and futures they must rebuild.
"How are you feeling?" Harrington asked.
"Good," Sean said. "How'd it go?"
"We're meeting for dinner tomorrow."
"A date?"
Harrington smiled. "I don't know if I'd go that far."
The rhythm of the ocean and the sounds of the city surrounded them, a symphony of man and nature. Sean said,
"It'll work out. You'll see."
Harrington nodded.
"I think you're right."
"Of course I'm right. Remember?"
He tapped his brow. "Genetic augmentation." Harrington laughed. When the former detective got out of the hospital, he'd found Sean sitting on the steps outside his apartment, and he took the younger man in. Sean stayed on the futon, and Harrington moved into the bedroom. They cleaned the place and made it hospitable. They bought food and other necessities online and had everything delivered. Otherwise, they kept themselves barricaded in and checked the neighborhood through the window for signs someone was watching them. Footsteps in the hall or the slam of a door, and they scrambled for their guns. Harrington slept with his under his pillow, and Sean didn't sleep much at all. But time passed with no sign of black SUVs or sedans that carried men in black suits. They slipped into the familiar rhythms of life. Harrington got a part-time job at an impound lot and a membership at the local gym. He went cold turkey and quit drinking. The news networks tore into the story about the events at the Café Del Mar like jackals. Cameras panned over the charred shell of the restaurant at various angles, while a husky male voice gave a dramatic narration of events. Interviews of the few patrons who'd remained inside and took cover behind chairs and beneath tables ran ad nauseam. Their stories about what had happened were as varied as the weather. Yet not a single video of it existed. Sure, several witnesses recorded it. In a world where people had developed a reflex to record everything from once-in-a-lifetime events to kittens chasing laser pointers, it was inevitable. But the smartphones of everyone who'd been within a one-block radius of the Café Del Mar had been wiped clean and bricked. Even the live streams vanished without a trace. Victoria had pulled it off. Sean still stayed in the apartment. He needed time for the story to fade and the networks to move on to the next great disaster or celebrity scandal. When it came to headlines, the public had a severe case of anterograde amnesia. He read books and watched shows and grew a beard. His disguise. The visions of Vietnam didn't go away.
but they stopped being blackouts and became something manageable, like memories. He remembered more, too. More memories from... what had Dodd called him? The original specimen. His father had died in the Korean War, and it nearly broke his mother in two. That's why he went off to Vietnam. He'd volunteered to honor his father, and also to protect his daughter, but the whole thing had turned out to be pointless, and in the end, all he'd wanted was to see her again. But he never made it home. Sean wondered what happened to them, his wife and his daughter. He hoped they'd been proud of his sacrifice, mourned him, and moved on. He hoped they'd lived good lives. But Sean had to remind himself these weren't his memories. His began and ended in New York, where he'd been manipulated and used by Roman Biogenics, and picked up again 3 years later in Amarillo. That was his life. Only this and nothing more. He was okay with it. Sean left the apartment for the first time after about a month went by. A simple foray to the grocery store with Harrington. On the way, they passed a newsstand, and that familiar urgency greeted him like an old friend. He stopped and stared. Harrington put a hand on his shoulder, and Sean clenched the newspaper he'd carried from the apartment. Harrington had bought it when Sean moved in, and they'd checked its classifieds and found no hidden triggers. The theory was that if Sean brought it with him, he could resist reaching for a new one, because maybe they still left messages, like a voice on an open party line, just in case someone was listening. Sean reread his newspaper's headlines. Harrington was right. It didn't make the urge go away, but it kept him moving. In time, he could pass the newsstand without a second thought, and he quit worrying someone would give him a sideways glance and a double take and recognize him. He was just another asshole on his way to buy groceries, which suited him fine. His newspaper became faded and stained, the ink smudged. It started to yellow, but that was okay too. Before long, he'd toss it. He could do this, not just survive, but build a life. Now, as the last of the day drowned in the black waves of the Atlantic, he mulled over his decision. It had been difficult, but he knew he'd made the right choice. "Sam," he said, "I'm leaving." Harrington nodded and stared at the ocean. "I figured," he said. "Any idea where you'll go?" Roman Biogenics had kept its name out of the news. The world didn't know what they'd done. What they were still doing, building clones, creating designer killers, superhumans without pasts, the perfect assassins. President Hoyt knew, though. Sean had no doubt he'd been complicit in all of it. Dodd said they'd use the other clones for research, like they were nothing more than rats in cages. Could Sean really just walk away and let that happen? Let it keep happening? He didn't think so. Besides, people deserved to know the truth. But that wasn't on Harrington. After everything he'd sacrificed for Sean, the man deserved peace and a chance to rebuild his life. So Sean told him none of this. He only shrugged and said, "Wherever the dreams take me, I'll start with North Carolina." "You're not leaving until you meet Jenny, though," Harrington said. "You'll like her. Not to mention, she'll think I lost my mind if she doesn't see for herself that you're real. Coincidentally, you are real, right?" Sean smiled. "What are you going to tell her?" "The truth." Sean nodded. He paused and said, "Thank you for..." He swept his arm across the horizon. Harrington smiled, and they stood in silence, enjoying the smell of the ocean and the sand beneath their feet, and each other's company. Two men on a path to rediscover what's left of their lives and to set things right. Behind them stretched the city, waiting to wrap them in her embrace. but she offered only a false sense of security. Beneath the veneer of glamour and sophistication, there lurked something dark and sinister. When all was said and done, she wasn't an apple, but a leviathan. Within her streets, mankind waged a war of all against all that echoed in cities and between nations across the world. Life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, and it would get worse. But that came later. For now, the two men stood together on the beach, thankful to be alive, and, finally, at peace. The last sliver of the sun sank into the ocean, marking the death of another day. Don't mourn its loss, though. In the morning, it shall be reborn. Thank you for listening to The Eighth Day, written by Joseph John and performed by James Romick. Copyright 2016. The Eighth Day is available in print from Obsidian Dawn Publishing. To be the first to hear about new book releases from the author, visit www.josephjohnfiction.com.